The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Dan Newland. He joins us on the telephone in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Hi, Vic. How are you? Thanks a lot.
Are you enjoying your visit back to your home state?
Yeah, I always do. I come back annually and, get back together with friends and family and contacts and so forth. It's one of those expatriate things where you're kind of always with one foot in one place and one foot in the other.
That's right. You're an expatriate. You live in Argentina, and you've written a number of books. Now, was your first book the one about the Temple of Tolerance, or did you write books before that?
That's right. That was the first. That was the first book. I've made my living for the past half century with the written word, but had never gotten around to writing the books that I wanted to write. So that's now at 75 years old, I kind of figure that's what I can do. So I'm writing all the books that I didn't write before.
Okay. Well, I'm sure our listeners are interested in these books. And before we get to the most recent one, why don't you give us a little capsule of the previous ones? Let's start off with the Temple of Tolerance, because I'm sure we have listeners out there who have never heard of this. And this is in your hometown.
That's right. Actually, I went to school with the fellow who founded it, Jim Bowser. The book is called The Rock Garden and Other Stories, because actually it was about that, but other things as well. Jim was a very unique character. He just died about a year ago. And he was ahead of me a year in school, and we really had nothing to do with each other in school because we hung out with different crowds and things like that. And I had all these friends that were constantly saying, you really should meet Jim Bowser. You went to school with him. You don't know him. And I'm like, well, I know him to see him, but he was sort of the one-eyed kid at school because he had an eye knocked out by a rope when he was a kid. And so that made him kind of unique to begin with. But Jim was a very strange character, and all these people were constantly trying to get me together with him, and I just never did. And we didn't become friends till we were in our 60s. But then we became very close friends, and I was always lamenting the fact that, we hadn't known each other earlier in life. Jim created this area, which is, it's very hard to describe. It's an incredible place. He had over the years acquired the whole center of the block behind his house. It's just this kind of a common ordinary house, except it's got all these rocks outside too. And it has, sort of a Vietnam era bomb hanging from above that says peace on it and things of that sort. But this whole area in back of his house was turned into an incredible rock yard in which he brought in nobody, he never let people see when he was doing it. So, but it was all done kind of like the way they built the pyramids with levers and things like that. And he brought in rocks of significance. They all had some sort of significance, either for him. Some of them are cut stone, some of them are regular stone, but they all have had some significance for him. The same was true of his house. He had this really eccentric house with all sorts of items that were very eclectic, which every one of them had a story behind him. Like people sometimes would come and say, I wanted to give you this because it might be nice for your collection or whatever. And he would say, well, okay, what's the story behind it? And say, oh, I don't know. I just found it, or I bought it, or whatever. And he'd say, well, I'm not interested, because what was interesting to him was the story. Hmm. So he had all of these items. He was almost like an historical hoarder. And he had all these items that were like there were a lot of, for instance, Holocaust things, but also a lot of Nazi things. So it was completely eclectic, and each thing that was there had some kind of a story behind it. So I found him a really fascinating guy, and I started hanging out with him a lot every time I came back to, you know, the local area and back to my hometown of Wapakoneta. And I eventually decided I was going to write a book about him. So I wrote a book that was about the rock garden itself, about Jim, and then about a road trip we took together to Malabar Farm down by Mansfield, which was kind of a magical trip, actually, because he also is was friends with Mark Jordan, who's a sort of famous writer from that area, and I also put in a story which he told me. This was a legend that we had in my hometown about a murder that occurred and was never solved. And he said that he had solved it. So he told me his story, and I put it in as he told it. So it was an interesting book, a small but very interesting book. And that was the first one.
It's still open to the public?
It is, yes. They now have a curfew. You can't be there at night. It used to be that, you know, sort of picking people would get together there and play it on Thursday nights. And it was very interesting from that standpoint. And there were a lot of, but he actually built that for kids. Not as a playground, but rather as a safe place for troubled kids, because he worked a lot with kids with problems with either parents who were addicts, or they were addicts, or whatever, or were in and out of jail and in and out of juvie, et cetera.
Wow.
And so he had some really interesting stories about that. But then it became just kind of a public place that was a gathering place for anybody who was willing to get together there and not and just be tolerant of each other. No political arguments, no religious arguments. No, you know, it was just a place for people to get together and be kind to each other.
Well, bless his heart. Well, going through your bibliography, yeah, looking at how we just talked about your first book, and we have a very limited amount of time, let's hit your other books really fast, and then we'll hit the current one. And then, if we have time, we can talk about this Argentinian memoir that you're working on, okay? That'll be our reward for the listeners. So the second book that came out, is that Visions of What Used to Be? Briefly, what is that?
That's right. That was the second one. That's basically just stories about growing up in small-town America. It's set in my own town, but, I mean, that could be any town in the Midwest, basically. And so it's different stories, different characters, people of real interest to me. My whole idea about writing is that everybody has a story. There's nobody that doesn't have a story, no matter how boring their life might look. We all kind of have a public life, a private life, and a secret life. And so, you know, people's stories are always of interest to me. And I also wrote there about 5 and 10s, things that have disappeared, and used that line from Beautiful Ohio, which, you know, it's Visions of What Used to Be, as my theme.
And then the next one is from a place called Wapakoneta.
That's right. That one is all Wapakoneta stories and is more of the same. It's basically a second volume of stories about a Midwestern small town and the people in it.
You're so lucky to have tracked down Dan Newland, who is in from Argentina, visiting the home place, and he's going to have an event coming up, and I'm going to tell you about that. But first, we need to tell you about his new book. It's called Other Worlds, Destinations on the Road of Life. And I was up last night watching that 18-inning World Series, and I still had about 50 pages left to finish in your book, and I couldn't believe it. that game went so long, I was able to finish your book during the commercial breaks. It was completely insane.
Yeah, the commercial breaks are long. You're right. Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about this book.
Okay, as I say, the other three books were set in the Midwest and sort of in my era, which was, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But I've lived outside the country for, as I say, a half century. So I decided that I should write another book of essays in which I talked about other places, other people, other, you know, sort of other lives and other worlds. And so I wrote a lot in that one about Argentina. I spent 20 years in Buenos Aires as a journalist, so I know a lot about that city. I know it like the back of my hand, and I have, you know, I have still have friends there, and I go several times a year from Patagonia, where I live now. But I also wrote in that book about Patagonia, about what it's like to live in one of the last wild frontiers, and to be, I'm a private warden for about 70 acres of natural forest. So writing about that, the changing of the seasons, the getting ready for winter and having to stock up on firewood and things of that sort, things that aren't very usual to most people. So it's kind of urban and rural in its context. And I also added some stories about other places. Like, for instance, I happened to be in New York for the blackout in 2003. I just happened to be there. I was staying with a friend in Harlem, and so wrote about that. That book is basically saying, I have lived my life in two completely different worlds, and trying to give a sort of true reflection of both of those worlds. And that's why I did that third book.
Okay.
That fourth book, rather.
Let's dip in. Just briefly, let's dip into a few of these essays. I have some favorites in here, and I just like to point them out to you and have you maybe talk about them a little bit. In the essay, okay, Michigan Dreaming, you go to this lake.
Yes.
And I love this essay about you and your relatives and this guy that you worship that had this little resort. Tell us about this.
Yeah. We used to go from the time I was about, an infant, really, to the age of about 10. We used to go every year for about a week, which seemed like such a short time, to a place in the northern peninsula of Michigan. It's a little lake, little crystal lake called Lake Manistee. And back then, if you go there now, I mean, they're like paved roads and things like that. But back then, it was all dirt roads. It was all natural forest and this lake. And my grandfather had worked for years my grandfather was a life insurance salesman for Western and Southern Life Insurance. And he had worked with a fellow called Morris Butcher, who just one day went out for cigarettes and never came back. He kind of walked out, and he went up to Michigan, and with his son, they built, I think there were about five or six very rustic cabins there. And he created a resort, which he called the Buckeye Rustic Resort. And that was the place we would go. And for me, he was just like bigger than life. That guy, you know, he knew all about fishing. He knew all about the lake. He knew all about the animals in the forest. And it was a great relationship that I had with him as a child. But he and my grandfather were very close friends, but it was kind of like Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon and Grumpy Old Men. You know, I mean, they fought all the time, but really loved each other and were really very close. So
I love the fight they have about the fishing lure. That is hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my grandfather was always doing these things like not tying, asking to borrow one of his lures and not tying them on tight. And then when he would cast, you would see this lure flying out over the lake, you know, and he would say, look at that cast. And the other would say, well, you fool, you just threw my lure out in the middle of the lake, you know. So they were great stories.
My favorite part of that one is when you describe your dad's ritualistic first swim upon arrival. This is such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, my father was a World War II vet. We didn't know much about, like most guys from World War II, he didn't want to talk about it. And he only talked a little about it to me when I was in the Army. He suffered from what then was called manic depression, which today they call, you know, bipolar syndrome. But at that time, he was going through Great Depression. It was before they actually were able to start medicating him and things like that. It was before things like Prozac existed. And so he worked very hard in a restaurant that he owned. He never worked less than, you know, 12 hours a day. And so the vacation for him was kind of a big deal, but he couldn't really disconnect from the things that were bothering him in life, you know, debts and how the restaurant was running and how his own home life was running, et cetera. And this ritualistic swim that he had, my father had been a very good swimmer in his youth and then had been a champion sort of underwater swimmer in the Army. And so every year when we would get there, the first thing he would do before the vacation really started for him was swim across the lake. And he did all of that underwater. His ritual was always that. My father was not a surface swimmer. He could swim on the surface, but he always swam underwater. So it was all just taking very long dives and going, you know, for a very long distance in which I would be holding my own breath and trying to see if I could, imitate him. And there was just no way that I could possibly hold my breath as long as he did. And I would get worried that he had drowned and so forth watching from the shore. And he would leave me to take care of his things so that I wouldn't follow him into the water. He would say, well, you know, you have to take care of my shoes and my clothes and all this stuff. And he would just go in and he would swim completely across the lake and then all the way back. It was a pretty amazing feat. And especially for a man who his only exercise was his work. He was always in very good shape just because he was naturally in shape. I mean, my father looked like a middleweight all his life. It was almost a religious experience for him. He would swim across that lake and all the way back, and that was when his vacation started.
As we look back at the fact that, gosh, you know, we probably live longer than we have in the future to live, you know, unless we live to be like 100 and some years old, you know, you're looking back at your life and you're going, oh, man, I had some close calls. You talk about some medical close calls that you had. And then the boot camp essay. I love the boot camp essay. And, oh, man, I laughed so hard. And I was hoping that when that one guy did what he did to you, you would react to him. And by golly, you sure did. That was very satisfying. And in that one, you're at a fort that's named after a Confederate. And I was thinking, I bet you Dan is really looking at our current affairs here in this country and kind of shaking his head and scratching his head and going, man, what is going on in the USA?
Well, I really am. Many of my friends are liberals. A lot of them are writers or painters or musicians, et cetera. But I have others too that I simply can't understand how they don't see what's happening. And that frightens me because I have lived it. I have lived watching a democracy fall apart and eventually being an authoritarian government and then having another authoritarian government take it over. And people just don't understand that. I think the basic thing people should understand, and if they don't, they will never understand authoritarianism. And that is that, you know, all of us want to see our enemies crushed. And so you say, well, I don't care if they, you know, arrest so-and-so because he doesn't agree with me. And I think he probably should be in jail, et cetera, et cetera. And that is exactly the attitude that that's how democracies die. When people quit saying, you know, well, I don't agree with this guy at all, but he has rights. He should have due process. He should, you know, and he can't be arrested for what he says. I just read an article, which I found so shocking, about a fellow who was a former policeman. He had been a police officer, and then he had been a deputy sheriff, and then he had worked in corrections. He had been a prison guard, and he had retired. He was in his 60s, and he was writing about what was happening, and he was talking about authoritarianism and so forth on Facebook. And he lived in Lexington, Kentucky, and in the middle of the night, the police came and arrested him. He was watching television with his wife at 11 o'clock at night, and they came and they cuffed him and they took him away. And he had no idea what he was being taken away for. And they were just all trumped up charges against him because of the fact that he had been speaking out. Now, this is scary. This is really, really scary. This guy's going to be in jail. They put a $2 million bail up. I mean, they don't do that for the worst criminals. And all this man is guilty of is practicing free speech. He will be in jail until December when he actually gets, you know, his day in court, because he can't pay to get out. And so he'll spend his time for the next 2 months in jail until he can actually be tried. This is very scary. These are things that only happen under authoritarianism. And this is what I keep trying to tell people, because I've been there, done that. I worked for 13 years for a newspaper that, during the 7 years of the military dictatorship in Argentina, we spent all of our time tracking cases of people who were disappearing, tracking cases of people who were being murdered, and writing editorials about basically human and civil rights, what the basic rights of people are. And when we start wanting to see our so-called enemies jailed, that's where we get into trouble. That's where we get into trouble, because if you're jailing people for what they think or for what they say, then we're talking about authoritarianism at its worst.
And Dan, you were a newspaper editor in Argentina for a newspaper that was an English-speaking newspaper, and it was owned by a group out of South Carolina. And another favorite essay of mine is when you go to South Carolina to visit these people that own the newspaper, but I'll leave that for readers to discover. And there's so many great essays in Other Worlds, Destinations on the Road of Life by Dan Newland. And you are working on a memoir about your days as a newspaper editor right now?
I am writing a book, which I have been writing for the last 20 years. And my mentor and former boss at that newspaper is 91 now, and he still has not been able to write a memoir about it, because those times were very complex and very emotional times for us. And so it's very hard to do this. But I decided that, you know, at 75 years old and seeing what's going on in the world, that was a book I needed to write. So I am finishing it. I hope to finish it by the end of this year, by the end of next year, rather, and to have it out by then. It's going to be called A Voice in the Storm, and it's about the time that I spent during the military dictatorship in Argentina from 1976 to 1983, working as a journalist and human rights activist for this newspaper and as a foreign correspondent.
You're listening to the Book Nook. I've been joined on the telephone in Cleveland by Dan Newland, and I mentioned he has an event coming up, and that is this week, Wednesday, November 5th. He will be at Wapakoneta, his hometown, at the Riverside Arts Center, signing copies of his books, and that's at 3 West O'Glaze Street from 6 until 8 o'clock that evening at the Riverside Arts Center. And I'm so glad I was able to track you down. I laughed at so many of these essays that you've written. It's not a book of humor, but you do have a good sense of humor. And I got a real kick out of the one about Ambrose Bierce, because at one point you said, quote, "Even the often jaundiced and disdainful New York Review of Books and Washington Post critic Michael Derda concedes, blah, 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 if snottily." And I've had him on this program. I got a real laugh about you're slamming Michael Derda. That was great. Okay. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time today, and I hope you have a good rest of your visit. And I'm wondering, I have my own views about this, but my last question revolves around just if you had to think really suddenly about one of your favorite things about Ohio that comes to your mind, just the top of your mind. And let me give you an example. If I was to do this, I would say something like the sound of the bugs in high summer out in the trees in Ohio is one of my favorite things in the world. What would you say is one of your favorite things about Ohio?
I think probably the old black and white winters. I love winter scenery, and Ohio is some of the most beautiful because of that, because there's a starkness that is really, really beautiful about it.
That is, I totally agree with you. That is a perfect image. Thank you very much for that. Well, thank you for your time, too. This has really been a pleasure to talk to you, Dan. I've heard a lot about you over the years, especially after you wrote about the Temple of Tolerance. We have a gentleman up in that area who's just been saying, you need to talk to Dan Newland.
I think I know who that was.
Yeah, I think you do. Okay. Well, thanks again, Dan.
Thanks so much, Vic. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Dan Newland. His new book is Other Worlds, Destinations on the Road of Life, and he'll be up there this coming Wednesday in Wapakoneta signing copies of that, as well as I'm sure he'll have some copies of his other books, and those are The Rock Garden and Other Stories, Visions of What Used to Be, and A Place Called Wapakoneta, and these are all published by this imprint that he has created called Patagonia Yankee Publishing, and it's got this image of a tree, and tell us about the tree before I let you go.
Those are called flag trees. Patagonia is a very windy place, particularly in the steppes of Patagonia. And you have persistent winds which create these trees which have all their branches on one side, and they always look like they're in the wind whether they are or not. And I just thought that was so typical of Patagonia that I used it as the logo for my imprint.
And they call them flag trees?
Flag trees, yes.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again, Dan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.